I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, we are back on a Saturday recording day. Are you excited?
I am excited. New place for me. Maybe we'll get into that at some point. But I'm especially excited for our guest today. And our guest is Nancy Kress. She's the author of 33 books.
Wow.
She's won 6 Nebulas, 2 Hugos, a Sturgeon, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award. Her most recent book is If Tomorrow Comes, the sequel to Yesterday's Kin. And Nancy, thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'm excited to be here too. So we're all excited.
Yes, it's an exciting time. Before we get into anything else, you have a new book out, which is the sequel, which is the second book in this series. I don't know if there's going to be more than 2 books, but maybe you can let our listeners know a little bit about the series so far.
Originally, it started with a novella, Yesterday's Kin, which won a Nebula. But then when I looked at it, I realized the story was not done. So I wrote the rest of it, keeping Yesterday's Kin as the first third of the book, and then writing a novel. And then I realized the story wasn't done. So I wrote If Tomorrow Comes. And then I realized the story wasn't done. So I wrote the third book, Terran Tomorrow, which will be out in November from Tor. And finally, the story is done, I think. Aliens suddenly show up on Earth, and they're here to give us a warning that there's a spore cloud, a deadly spore cloud, which already hit one of their planets, drifting our ways. And of course, half of Earth doesn't believe them. And the other half wants to believe them, but wants them to be something other than they are, because what they are is extremely surprising. And then the first book takes place on Earth while we are working against great odds against this menace of the spore cloud. And that doesn't turn out the way anybody expects either. In the second book, If Tomorrow Comes, that just came out last month, some of the Earthmen go to their planet. And on the third book, a bunch of people, both Terrans and Worlders, come back to Earth. So there's an arc there of space travel.
Fantastic. Wow. That sounds great. Now, you said this started as a novella. Was that through Tor too, or how was that released?
No, it came out from Tachyon in, I think, 2016. Tachyon is a small press that does standalone novellas, among other things. They publish them, and they do a marvelous job. So they published Yesterday's Kin, which became the novel Tomorrow's Kin, as a standalone. The novella is my favorite form. It's long enough to create an entire world or alternate fantasy reality or alternate future, but it's short enough that you only need one plot line, whereas in a novel, you need several braided plot lines, and I'm not as comfortable with that. All my awards have been for short fiction and most of them for novellas.
I love novellas, and I'm really happy that kind of the digital boom has made publishers willing to put out novellas again, because for a while there it was just really small publishers and presses like you're talking about that were doing it. Now a lot more people are getting into it and publishing more.
Yes, I just finished one that is going to go someplace. Since I only finished it yesterday, I'm not sure exactly where, but it's a novella too.
Well, and if you want, and if you're crazy like I am, you can just push them out yourselves. I have several that are in a series called Cord Cahill that I just pushed out myself.
You mean you're self-published?
Yes.
Yeah, but you can actually use a computer. You have no idea how bad I am at this. I want somebody else to do it all.
I completely understand. I do. I go to some writers' conferences occasionally, and I'll teach people how to use Scrivener to do this kind of stuff. And I get that same thing. It's like, well, can I just hire you to do it?
I know. I teach every year with Walter John Williams a 2-week intensive workshop called Taos Toolbox that teach in Taos, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And around the table, there will be 18 people with their laptops and me with a huge stack of paper. It's a little embarrassing, but this is the way I work.
Yeah. Well, and there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's just how you work. And that's the other thing. Like when I teach people how to use Scrivener, they're like, why should I switch from Word to Scrivener? Or why should I switch from my notebook to Scrivener? And it's like, you shouldn't if what you're doing is working for you.
Yeah, Connie Willis and I are the Luddites. She's even worse than I am because she only writes on paper and has a typist type it in. I at least can use Word on the computer.
I love Connie. Connie is local here, mm-hmm. and I get to see her every year at Mile High Con.
Oh, yes. I will see her in – I'm guest of honor at WesterCon in Denver in July, and I will see her then.
I was almost your guest of honor liaison.
Oh, I wish you had been.
I had to pass on it because of stuff going on at the house. But, yeah, I plan on being there as well.
Oh, good, good.
Well, I was going to say, I've read a Kurt Vonnegut novel many years ago that I believe he wrote mostly on bar napkins that he just had – And that, if you know anything about Kurt Vonnegut and his life, like, it's not so surprising. But it was an interesting book. I forget which one it was because I read a lot of Kurt Vonnegut a long time ago, and it was they had sort of the breaks on the page, so you knew it was like this was this napkin, and I mean it didn't look like napkins. It was just like there would be a line separating it, but it was surprisingly cohesive and worked. I think it was an experiment. Maybe he just got the idea for the novel while he was out one night and wrote it on a napkin and just kept going that way. So,
or else he spent a lot of time in bars and just wrote it there, kept going.
I'm sure that was part of it too. I think there's something to be said about the sort of analog technology of writing and of paper. I'm someone that's pretty comfortable with computers and the digital thing too, but I think your brain, there's something about the experience of actually writing it down on something physical. I know with a lot of the nonfiction that I read, and we can even get into this more later because it's going to be our main topic. But when I take notes on a nonfiction book, it might be digital at first, but then what I end up doing is I will then print out that digital copy and then I'll go through those notes and then write whatever I find important on index cards. And I have this big photo box that fits 4x6 index cards. And I put them in there. I got this idea from a guy named Ryan Holiday, who's a nonfiction author. And I find it's a great way to retain whatever, because I would read all these books and then, you know, you'd forget whatever it was you were trying to learn from it. But this way, by sort of going through that kind of editing process and kind of getting it down and rewriting it and then putting it into forms where I can then take that box out. And then I don't really have it that well organized yet, but you know, I'm eventually going to have it organized on fairly decent topics. So it's like, oh, if I want to read a little bit about this, I'll take out all my index cards that were about this and kind of thumb through them. And it's a great way. To me, I'm retaining so much more that way. So I think there's something to be said about that physical part.
That is a good idea. That is a good idea. But I'm afraid that I do something different when I'm reading nonfiction, which I do a lot. I deface the books. My husband has a fit, but they're my books. I underline in them, I write notes in the margins. And then when I go through them again to refresh myself, I just go to where my underlining and my margins are. He's horrified by this, but he has respect for the physical object that I'm afraid I don't.
Your husband and I would get along really well because I'm horrified right now.
I do that when I have, because a lot of my nonfiction I read digitally on a Kindle. So I sort of take my notes with my finger, and that's where the index cards come in. But I do that if I do have a book that is a physical book. Yeah, I've gotten to the point where I highlight everything and I put those little, I have those little tabs that you can then stick in to sort of save where you're doing it. And I've taken a lot of notes and then I'll go through that and then do my index card. So it's like this big, but a lot of my physical nonfiction books are marked up and there's all those little tabs sticking out. I'll have like 100 tabs sticking out. It's crazy. but then it's nice because you're right, because you can either look at the cards or you could just pick up the book and go to those tabs and then go to your highlight and you're like, there you go. So to me, it's a great way to do it.
See, for me, it's difficult, and I can put it to you like this. My mom was absolutely 100% certain I was going to be a doctor solely based on my handwriting.
Oh, moms are so often wrong.
And my teachers used to have meetings with my mom and my dad, my parents basically calling them in saying, what are you doing to him when he's at home? Because we're not teaching him this crap and his handwriting is just horrible. And they would have these meetings and they would have these intensive things that I would have to do. And my handwriting just never got better. It's just horrible to this day. And I can't write with a pen as fast as my brain is going.
Are you dyslexic?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't flip words. But when I start writing, my brain starts going faster than I'm writing. And then my handwriting starts getting worse and worse and worse as I'm trying to catch up to my brain. I can type a heck of a lot faster and I can keep up with my brain.
Well, my handwriting is pretty good because I print. When I first graduated from college back in the early Triassic, I taught the fourth grade for a few years and the third grade. And you have to teach writing, cursive.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I learned to write very clearly and I print faster than I type because, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, I type with one finger, 600 page novels with one finger. So I can actually—
There's nothing wrong with that.
It works. It's a very fast finger by now.
What's the guy who does all the Goosebump books?
I know who you mean, but I can't think of his
name. R.L. Stein.
R.L. Stein. He also types with one finger.
Does he?
Oh, every single one of those books.
I'm so pleased there's somebody else. I can do, are you ready to be astonished? 27 yes. words a minute in a good minute.
Wow.
With short words.
Yeah, I can't. It's just terrible. I'm much faster typing. And so the other part is, like you talked about, Connie handwriting and then handing it to someone and having them type it up. I would never put someone through that.
Oh, well, she
would not be able to read my stuff.
She has a secretary. And I think she, you know, consciously makes it easy.
Better. Gotcha.
Once, when we were all much younger and much poorer, a group of female science fiction writers were sitting around, and somehow the question came up, if you had a choice, and neither of us could afford either one at that time, would you rather have a house cleaner or a secretary? And everybody picked house cleaner except Connie, who picked secretary.
And who did she want Silverberg to be the secretary?
Well, wouldn't we all want Silverberg to be the secondary?
Oh, my goodness. Nice. I had a thought and I lost it, John. Keep going.
That's okay. You know, I was going to say that we could maybe go on to our next section. Before we do that, I do want to thank all the people who back and support the podcast over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Your pledge really helps us to put on a good show every week, get fantastic guests like Nancy, have some good audio quality, all that good stuff. So for the people that are already backing us, thank you so much. It means the world to us. If you're listening to the show and you're considering becoming a backer, just go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can pledge $1 a month or whatever amount you'd like, $10 a month. You could do that too if you want. That's great. Whatever you do, it really helps us out. It helps us put the show out every week and hopefully keep building it and keep making it good for you. So thanks so much. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Nancy, why don't you go first and give us your pick of the week?
Okay, I'd like to recommend a book, which is kind of surprising for me to recommend because it's fantasy. I mostly read science fiction, not fantasy. But this one is a real standout. It's contemporary fantasy. It's Spoonbenders by Daryl Gregory. It's on the Nebula ballot for best novel. And it is really, really interesting. It's about a family of psychics, some of which are real and most of which are charlatans and know it and admit it. And it has an extremely intricate braided plot. But the reason that I liked it is because the characters are so interesting and individual and have such depth, and because Daryl Gregory can really write. He has a way with metaphors that is easily the equal of any of our best mainstream writers. So Spoonbenders, Daryl Gregory, read it.
Awesome. Yeah, I have a bunch of those Daryl Gregory books sitting here, and I got to get to them because everyone raves about him. So he's—
Haven't we had him on?
I don't think we ever had Daryl on.
I may have had him on SF Signal then.
That's entirely possible.
You should have him on.
Yes. You know what? I'll make that happen then. We'll say, Nancy Kress said we have to have you on, so get on here. All right. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
Mine is a dual pick because I had two books sitting out there that needed to be read. One is a novella. Yay! And both by the same author. And one finishes a series, and the other is just kind of a bridge between two books. And it's Scourged and The Squirrel on the Train by Kevin Hearn.
Mm.
And The Squirrel on the Train is part of Oberon's Meaty Mysteries. Oberon is the Irish wolfhound in the books, the Iron Druid books by Kevin Hearn. And if you are a fan of the series, you know that In the books, there is a druid named Atticus who has forged a mental bond with an Irish wolfhound. And through that bond, he's been able to use his magic to kind of up his intelligence a little bit and allow communication mentally between he and his dog. And Oberon is obsessed with lots of different things, including squirrels, who he thinks are secretly plotting the end of the world because squirrels. And the Meaty Mystery series are very, very funny. I mean, there's stuff going on, but they're very funny because it's essentially Oberon narrating a story. And he doesn't understand things like how, you know, time and how time passes. And he doesn't know if seconds last millennia or how long they are. Stuff like that. And he's constantly obsessed with meat and gravy and all that good stuff. And they solve some mysteries. And then Scourged is the last of the Iron Druid books in the series. It brings this particular storyline to a conclusion. We don't know if Kevin is going to do anything else in this universe or if he's going to move on, because we know he's done Plague of Giants. And he also has Kill the Farm Boy, which is co-written with Delilah Dawson. But I listened to the audiobooks, and Luke Daniels is an amazing narrator. He is basically doing three POVs inside of the Scourged book. He's doing Granuel, Owen Kennedy, and Atticus. And those three voices are very different and distinct, and he does a really good job. And for about a week, I was walking around talking like both Oberon and Owen, because Owen is an ancient druid from Ireland. And of course, Oberon is a dog who talks like this all the time and says, "Oh, Atticus, Atticus, can I have a sausage covered in gravy? Oh, Atticus, there's a squirrel on the train. We have to do something."
If squirrels are going to take over the world, they need better missiles than just a bunch of thrown nuts.
It's hilarious. Oh my God. He has three hounds at this point. He has Orla, Starbuck, and Oberon. And when the three of them see this squirrel on the train, they lose their minds, because that squirrels are not supposed to be on a train. How did a squirrel get on the train? And it's just hilarious. That kicks off the whole mystery. Those books are fantastic, and I recommend them to anybody.
And was it I know you've been reading those books for a long time. Was it satisfying for you? Did you feel pretty sad?
Yes. I flipped them. I didn't read The Squirrel on the Train first, because I figured there was a foreshadowing several books back where one of the Pantheon gods basically told Atticus that if he continues on this path, he is going to be very, very sorry and he's going to regret his decisions. So I knew that that was coming to a head. So I kind of flipped him and I listened to Scourged first, and I took the punch in the gut, you know, and it was a very good book, a very satisfying read, but there's definitely some emotions at the end as stuff comes to a head. And then I listened to the Squirrel on the Train to kind of, I wanted to laugh, and I knew that was going to make me laugh.
Nice.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. My pick this week, I actually read this a couple months ago, but when we were talking earlier about marking up our books, this was the last one that I marked up pretty good. So it is called Tribe of Mentors, Short Life Advice from the Best in the World. And this is by Tim Ferriss, who I've read a bunch of his books at this point, and I listened to his podcast. And while I was reading this, basically his last two books have been essentially his podcast in written form, where he has all these big, long interviews with various high achieving people in every field, authors, scientists, athletes, actors, music, like whatever you can get, someone who are, you know, the peak of whatever their field is. And he interviews them, and I enjoy the podcast. And as I'm reading the books, this book, I was not blown away as I was reading it. I was like, all right, that's fine. It's kind of like the podcast, some good stuff in here. However, when I went back and went through all of the notes that I took on it, there was a lot of excellent takeaways from it. Just lots of good advice on creating or on how to live your life. And if nothing else, this is a great book to get recommendations for other books, because one of the questions that he asks every one of the guests that he's had on is, what is the book that you've gifted the most, or what is the book that has had the biggest impact on you? So you'll get 50 great recommendations for books. And a lot of these books tend to come up more than once throughout it. So again, as I was reading it, it seemed okay because it was kind of like in an interview form. Every chapter is an interview with a different person. But by the end, lots of great takeaways, especially for creative people and for people who are just trying to do better in whatever field that they're in. So I got a lot out of it in the end. So it's called Tribe of Mentors, and it's by Tim Ferriss. That is
very
my
cool.
So Nancy, throwing it back to you now. Now, what we're going to talk about, which I think is really interesting to a lot of people in our audience, and that is integrating research into fiction. So how do you go about doing that in terms of, you know, you were telling us about your current novels that are out there. A lot of times do these novels start with a particular subject that you're interested in, that you're kind of curious about, that you're researching anyway, or do you come up with an idea first and then do your research? How does this whole process get started for you?
It usually gets started with a character and a situation. And I will often write the first scene at sort of a red hot heat. And then I will think, okay, where is this going? And the research part is really important to me because I write hard SF. A lot of it concerns genetic engineering. Occasionally it will concern physics. And it's important to me that I try to get it as right as possible. I get really annoyed with books that look like hard SF for a while, and then all of a sudden something happens that completely violates known science, not extends it, but completely violates it or throws magic into the mix when you're expecting science, or in other kinds of ways just knocks me right out of the story. And because I'm not scientifically trained, I have to do a lot of research about what I'm writing about. In the Yesterday's Kin series, for instance, it's genetically engineering vaccines and viruses. I know that doesn't sound like a very dramatic topic, but it is when you get an epidemic. And I spend a lot of time, first of all, researching what does exist, and then going beyond that to see what might exist in the future that I might be able to use for my plot. And I write it all very carefully out. We have index cards so far discussed, and we have Kindle markups, and we have book markups. At some point, I transfer everything I have to a legal yellow pads organized by topic. And I look at it, and I go over it, and I study it, because I know that my plot is going to be there in the research. And when that starts emerging, then I start organizing the research in my mind, and again on more yellow pads, so that I have the science very clear in my head. Again, because I'm not trained, I need to do this. All right. That's the first part. The second part is actually integrating it into the story. And the problem with this is that, well, two, first of all, because I'm working at what I think of as a fairly sophisticated level of science, it has to be made interesting and accessible to the reader. And the second problem is that it can't slow down the story. So there are a couple things that I do about this. First of all, if you're going to put in an info dump, for instance, on viruses, you have to create first in the reader a desire to know this information. The plot has to have proceeded in such a way that this information, they can see it's going to be relevant to what has happened and to what might happen. So you have to create the need to know before you introduce a lot of information. And the second thing you have to do is you have to place those scenes, whether they're info dumps or whether they're low-key scenes of discussions of scientific method or depiction of a team of scientists working, you have to place them correctly. And this is what I call the Kress swimming pool theory of fiction. If you can't dive, and I can't, when you kick off from the side of a swimming pool, you give a powerful kick with your legs, and then you can glide for a little while before you have to actually start swimming, unless you're Michael Phelps, in which case you better start instantly. An exciting and dramatic scene is the kick. That earns you a glide, which is a quieter scene, where you're introducing the science, or a flashback, which is quieter because even if it's exciting, it's out of story time, or an outright info dump if you keep it short enough. But you have to earn that right. So if you can create the need to know, the desire to know in your reader by what's gone before that's been actual action and character. And if you can place it correctly, you can get away with integrating quite a bit of hard SF into a story without slowing it down or losing reader interest.
Do you care at all for the Expanse novels by James S.A. Corey?
I read the first one. I haven't read the others. I liked it, yes.
I like the way that they do that. Because to me, I'm one of those people where if you give me too much hard science, you lose me. And I like the way they've done it with Leviathan Wakes as an example. You know, there's definitely some hard SF in there, and the way that the ships move, the way gravity works, all that kind of good stuff. I never felt talked down to, and I never felt info dumped or given so much information so fast that I couldn't keep up.
Because it's integrated with the plot. And what you just said raises the third thing. Keep the information section short. And then move on with something with more of the action and the character development. So, yeah, I put a great deal of hard SF in my stories because I think genetic and engineering is completely fascinating. This is the future. And I also do other kind of research. The book that just came out that you started by mentioning, If Tomorrow Comes, has three major characters. One of them is a carryover from the first book, and she's a middle-aged woman scientist, a geneticist. She's not that hard for me to write because even though I'm not a scientist, I am a middle-aged person, woman with children, as she is, although her children are a lot more difficult than mine. The second major character is a doctor. And although I'm not a doctor, my best friend is, and she goes over all of my manuscripts for me. But the third character was the challenge. And, you know, I don't know why I wanted to write him, but I really did. He's a 24-year-old male U.S. Army Ranger. This is about as far from my experience as it's possible to get. Nobody in my family has served in the military since World War II except my niece, and she's a Navy JAG, and she fights all her battles in the courtroom. But I wanted to write Leo. I just did. He seized a hold of my imagination. So I read four memoirs by Rangers who served in Iraq. I read the Ranger Handbook and can now construct a field antenna, should anybody need me to do this. I did a lot of research online. And then when I had finished, I hired a ranger, an ex-ranger, to go over the manuscript and tell me whether I was going to make a total fool of myself. And I was pleased both that he was able to tell me things I needed to change and that there weren't too many things I needed to change. So I was pleased with that. But that kind of research takes a lot of time and you have to be intensely interested in it. And then you also have the problem of integrating it without losing your audience.
Now, has that been your process for all 33 books?
No, my first three books were fantasy. And the books after that did not have as much hard science. This has slowly grown on me, the writing of hard SF. So a lot of them were what I would call soft science fiction, and then they went into a sort of high viscosity science fiction, but not actually hard. And then they've moved into hard science fiction, which I'm defining as science being central to the plot and not violating what we think we know about the universe.
And what happens to all those yellow legal pads after you've written the book?
Oh, I don't keep them. I don't keep stuff.
That's what I was wondering. I was wondering if you had like this huge house with a library in the basement where you're keeping all this information.
No.
Because that's a lot.
I'm the reverse of a hoarder. I keep the most important pages in a file, a single file folder for each novel and each story. But most of the stuff, plus the early drafts that I've printed out and edited on paper, I get rid of. I'm a minimalist.
We do have some librarians who listen to the show, and I think right now you just broke their heart because they were hoping to, you know, send you an email and say, could we host the Nancy Crest Library?
Well, the University of Southern Florida is already getting all my papers when the time comes. Yeah. My late husband, Charles Sheffield, archived his papers there, so I'm just going to put them on.
Okay. There you go. John, you still there?
Yeah, yes. I'm just listening. I'm taking it all in. I think, you know, going back to one of the things you said, I think that's a wonderful metaphor that you use about the kicking off of the beginning, and that's how you start Well, you said in the beginning that that's how every one of, or that's how you generally start your novels, is by writing that scene first. And I was thinking the sort of equivalent of that, you said you wrote fantasy early on, is instead of having a science thing at that point, oftentimes I think in good fantasy, that will be the time if there's like a little bit of history of the world or a little bit of backstory or an explanation of if there's a magic system or perhaps a pantheon of gods or something. Because I love all that stuff and I eat it up, but I also do realize that if it's presented in the wrong way, it's just, you're just giving stories, you know, you're just giving info dump out. So when you did write fantasy, did you sort of look at it the same way?
Well, I didn't, but I should have. I was just beginning to write, and I don't really like those early books. I like the first one. I don't really like the third one. And the second one I actively hate. When people bring it to me to sign at conventions, I write in it, please don't read this, read something else.
Oh no.
I really dislike it. It's a bad book. And part of it is that I didn't know enough to construct my fantasy system of magic ahead of time and consistently, because you have to do the same for fantasy as you do for science fiction. You need to construct your system ahead of time. It needs to make sense. It needs to be self-consistent. You need to understand it, and it needs to have depth. Look at George R. R. Martin's, especially the first three books of the Game of Thrones series. That world has got several different religions, each one self-consistent and making sense as to where and how and why it developed. It's got several different economic and political setups, and all of those make sense as well. He must have done an enormous amount of thinking or writing or planning before he began. And then once you know that, you can plunge in with the action because you don't have to think about it. It's there in your head, or at least it's on paper, along with the maps and the magic system. You understand it. And then you can concentrate as you're writing on the characters and the plot.
Do you think that new authors, though, can do too much research and basically go into research paralysis?
Yeah, I sometimes get students who feel that they can't move forward. Either they have too much stuff, or they feel they have to put every single thing they learned about, say, Tudor England into the story. And you don't. You have to prune and weed. The basic problem of writing, as I see it, is that while you're writing, you need to be three people. You need to be the creator who is thinking up this stuff and putting it down. You need to be the editor, but not too much the editor. But as you're going along, I'll say wrong word, and I'll take it out and look for a better one. You can't do too much of that or you will paralyze yourself, but you need to do some of it. You're the editor. But you also need to be the reader looking over your shoulder, because you know what this looks like, and the reader only knows what's on the page. When I see a scene unfolding in my head, it's like it's a movie. I see the characters walking around in the background at the same time that I see what they're wearing, at the same time that I hear their dialogue. It all happens as a multimedia event, a multisensory event. But writing is a linear event. You put down this detail and then this detail, this bit of description, this line of dialogue, this thought, another bit of description, two more lines of dialogue. You have to be the reader looking over your shoulder to see what impact those details in that order are making on someone who doesn't know what you already know. And it's a little schizophrenic. Well, actually, it's a lot schizophrenic, being those three people all at once. And I think there's a reason why most writers are a little nuts.
Well, the voices in my head disagree. I remember one of the first times I went to the Pikes Peak Writers Conference, and I was teaching Scrivener, and there was a lady who was telling me about her book, and it sounded really excited. And I said, well, you know, how much of it have you written yet? And she says, oh, I haven't written anything. I'm still doing research. And I said, okay, well, you know, how long have you been doing research? She says, well, about 6 or 7 years now.
Oh my God.
I've filled up 20 notebooks of research, you know, that I'm just doing. And I looked at her and I said, stop doing research. Start writing it.
Do you think she took your advice?
I know that she did, because she wrote the book since, and I want to say this was 2011, 2012. And I know that she did. She worked on a couple different things. Number one, being more extroverted because she was very, very shy. And so she started forcing herself to go to more events and meet more people and talk to more authors. And two, she wrote that book, wrote a draft, edited it, did another draft, so on and so forth, and eventually pushed it out there to try to get it published. So she did finally start doing that, but she needed that kind of kick.
That's really
good. Someone telling her.
Because some people never get past the research. Research, a lot of research is a really good excuse for not having to sit down and face the blank page.
Correct. I agree totally with that.
Yeah. The other thing is I've emphasized that I do all the science research up front, but I don't do all the other research. Usually I did for Leo because, again, he was such an alien creature to me when I first conceived him. But I will write along and I will say, for instance, I'll come to a point and I'll put in brackets to myself, find out how much a Labrador weighs, and then go on. I won't stop to do it then. I'll pick it up on the second draft if it's details, because I can research those later. If I need the name of some side streets in Venice, that can wait. I can just put in a marker, Street X, and go back later and get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's always, I've heard that a lot, that when you're writing, you should always kind of, with those kinds of things, because then now you're going to go on the internet and look up streets in Venice, and then you're going to find 10 other things, and now all of a sudden your writing flow is, you know, completely derailed.
But there's nothing worse than missing one of those little notes that you put in there for yourself and sending it out to people to read it, and then them coming back and saying, well, what is this bracket here for? You're like, oh, crap.
Oh, it happens. It happens. I have a story in Gardner Dozois' Best of the Year called Dear Sarah. And when he asked me to send it to him, I did not have the copy edited version from where it had originally appeared, which was an anthology edited by Jonathan Strawn. So I sent him what I had on my computer. And his copy editor sent me a very irate note saying, is this girl's name Sarah or Jane? Because you've used both. I changed it somehow and I didn't do it right.
I actually did the same thing. Oh my God. But I didn't say anything to Gardner Dozois. Gardner and I met a couple times at WorldCon. I invited him on the podcast. He's like, no one wants to hear my voice.
But that's ridiculous. His voice.
And I said, they'll love it.
Yes, of course they will. And Gardner is one of the most intelligent and well-read people I know. And he should go on your podcast.
Yes. But I had a critique group, and I was putting manuscript pages through the critique group trying to get feedback. And someone came back and said, you need to pick a name for this character. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they showed me where I had changed the name like halfway through.
Well, you know, I know how to do a global replace, but the reason I don't do it is I once did that. I changed a character's name from Mary to Claudia, and I just did a global. And what I ended up with was words, instead of summary, I got some Claudia and all of them. I didn't know to put a space in front of it. So now I'm very leery about using global replace.
Yep.
One of the things you said before, when you were talking about how when you're writing, you have to be three different things, it made me think, I'm a musician and a music teacher. And I, when you find someone who's an excellent improviser, like a jazz improviser, for instance, there is so much that is going on to get to that level where you're a composer and you have to know all of this theory and you have to be able to be melodic and you have to be able to integrate it within to the rhythm. And this is why these skills take years and years to develop, because it's 10 different things at once that you're trying to do.
Yes, I'm glad you said that, because writing too, I have students who are very disappointed, actually crushed, when their first story is rejected. And I tell them, if you wanted to be a concert pianist, you would expect to practice. And the same is true of writing. Unless you're Robert Silverberg, who did sell his first story, you need time to develop what you're doing and to integrate all of these things in the same way that a jazz musician would. Sometimes when I have a class, I will give them one of my very early, very unpublished, exceedingly bad stories. And we will practice critiquing on that, because I will say, there is nothing you're going to say that hurts my feelings on this. I know how bad this is. And a side effect of this, a benefit in addition to talking about critiquing skills, is that they see how awful you can be at the beginning and still have a career.
Yeah, I took a class in college on Indian music, and one of the professors that came in and spoke to us was saying how, you know, because we were music education students, and he's like, yeah, it's very different in India than it is here where, and this is what I teach, you know, concert band to fourth and fifth grade students. It's like, you know, we don't take a 9-year-old kid, have him practice for 10 weeks and then throw him up in front of everybody to play Jingle Bells. which is what we do, which, you know, it's kind of like, they don't really know what they're doing yet, but yet we're throwing them in front of everybody. And there's, you know, there's good reasons to do that too, you know, getting that sort of performance experience. But he was telling us that in India, it's, oh no, they practice for this long and they're working every day with their teacher, and it's years and years and years before any kind of performance happens on their own. Like, they might do a little performing with their teacher within a group, but it's a very long process to get there.
Well, you must be familiar with Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers.
Yes.
Where he talks about the 10,000 hours that it's necessary to be put in.
Oh, yes. Yes, John has quoted that a lot.
The late Frederick Pohl used to say you have to write 500,000 to 1 million words before you get any good.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm a songwriter too, and I remember someone told me at one point, and I kind of think it's pretty accurate from looking at my own body of work, was that he's like, yeah, you probably have to write about 100 songs before you start writing any good ones. And you know, the song is a different form. That's not 100 novels. 100 songs is different. But I looked back on songs that are, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, there might have been a couple of decent ones in that first 100, but I think what happens is you get more consistent. After you have that experience of writing that much, then you know what's work. I think what happens is you get good at knowing what to get rid of. Like, this song is kind of not happening. Let's throw that one away. Let's start a new one. And then you can start.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it.
Your critical sense improves, but also Gladwell makes the important point that it isn't just practice, it's directed practice. It's where you look at it and say, okay, this didn't work, but why not? And you do that. You have to be open-minded about yourself. I will occasionally have students who are really defensive. They belong to the change one comma on my great work of art and I know you didn't understand it school of writing. And they almost never get anywhere.
There's more of that than I think people realize. I've experienced that a few times myself at Pikes Peak Writers Conference. I was extremely excited because Carol Berg was going to critique my writing. And, you know, Carol came up through Pikes Peak Writers. That's where she met her, I believe, her editor for the first time and the person who actually ended up publishing her. And so, you know, she likes to give back to the community. She's coming back to Pikes Peak Writers, and she was really nervous about it. And I'm sitting in a round table with her where she's going to critique about 9 different people's works. And she's really nervous. And I've met her several times through Mile High Con, and we have a good rapport. And I said, I'll just go first. So, you know, she reads my stuff. She completely red pens it. And I was fine with it. I was like, yeah, I got a critique from Carol Berg.
Yeah.
And someone else sitting at the table, Carol was now feeling better, and she was giving very constructive criticism, and you know, she's kind of walking through stuff. And another person at the table, when Carol gave the feedback, this person excused themselves from the table, ran out of the room, devastated and angry, could not believe that anyone would have issues with their writing, and then apparently went to the bar and got drunk.
Yeah, I have had students like that. This is going to sound contradictory, but I think in order to advance as a writer, you have to have a certain amount of humility. And I think all of our best writers have it. Now, in a way, that's a little bit contradictory because God knows science fiction and fantasy abounds with enough egotists. But humility about your work and receiving information about it in the beginning is a little different than sort of general egotism. And I really think that our best writers have that humility and the rest don't.
And I think critique groups is where if you don't have it, you learn it.
Well, if you don't learn it, you're pretty much out of the critique group.
Exactly. And you'll bounce from group to group and you'll never get anything published and you won't know why. You won't understand why. And that's a problem. And there's been plenty of people that I've run into throughout the years who they get that feedback and they lose their shit. Excuse my language. And they flip out on it because they can't believe that you are criticizing them. And it can be pretty intense. And one of the things that I learned was just to sit there. Don't say anything when you're getting critiqued. Just listen. Soak it
in.
Yeah,
I tell my students, take notes while you're being critiqued. It will give your hand something to do besides shaking. And you won't have to look people in the eye. And then you'll have the notes after the dust is settled to look at later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I feel like we can do another hour. But we should probably start wrapping it up there.
Before you do, John, I want to know, you were talking about teaching kids. Do you know why there are no improvisational jazz marching bands?
Why? Why, Pat?
Because they'd all be walking off in different directions.
Yes. I can see that. Yes, I could see that one coming, I'm afraid.
Marching band is a whole thing that I never had anything to do with at all. I didn't come from that world, but that's a whole other thing. That is what my father-in-law, who is a great clarinetist who still plays in local orchestras, that marching band is what drove him out of teaching, and that's how he became an insurance salesman. When he was in his late 30s, he was just like, I'm out. I'm not doing this anymore. I don't want to be every week on a football field. I want to play the clarinet, and I don't want to do this. So that, and I'm sort of a similar mind on marching band. It's not the world I come from. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today. Once again, Nancy's newest book is called If Tomorrow Comes, and it's the sequel to Yesterday's Kin, which both are available now. Let us know anything else that you have that's coming out. Or you said a book three coming out too. What's the name of that one?
That one's called Taryn Tomorrow, and it will be out in November from Tor.
Fantastic. Now, we spoke a little bit about some cons. Do you have any upcoming con appearances? I know you mentioned one. What was that one again? And what are some of the other ones that you might be appearing?
Well, this coming weekend, next weekend, I'm going to be at Comic Fest in San Diego. And in July 5th through 8th, I'm guest of honor at WesterCon in Denver. And in September, I will be a guest of honor at CapClave in D.C. We're also
that's one that everybody always tells me to go to CapClave. That's the one that because I'm in New Jersey, so I'm not too far from Washington D.C. And people always tell me, like, yeah, you got to go to CapClave. That's a really good
one. I'm glad to hear that because I haven't been before. Also, I'll be going to WorldCon.
Fantastic! That's awesome.
Yeah, that's in San Jose.
Yeah, I'm in Seattle, and San Jose is more or less next door. So, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been delightful.
Oh, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Everyone, if you enjoy these conversations with Nancy, consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And Patrick, anything you want to leave our listeners with before we go?
It's just another reason to go to WesterCon this year.
Yeah.
Nancy's going to be there. So.
All right. Fantastic. All right, everybody. Nancy, thank you again. And everyone have a great week.
Thanks, Mo.
Say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.